Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Winter officially begins on December 21st, but temperatures are already dropping, and homeless shelters are bracing for record numbers. I'm out in the cold. More and more, the homeless are the working poor whose homes were washed away in the flood of foreclosures. The new homeless are your friends and neighbors seeking shelter. I'm out. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 20th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up, we learned that avoiding work may turn out to be an aid to productivity in the brain. And we assessed the power of Barack Obama to save some troubled Democrats and his possibly waning power to woo contributions from Wall Street. And they're undefeated in Denver, football-wise anyway. And where else are they undefeated? We'll find out.
First, Vanessa LaBarca is with us. She's a single mother in Boston who ended up in a homeless shelter with her daughter after she was laid off. Vanessa, after you lost your job, how long was it before you also lost your home?
It was only a few months. I didn't have any savings, and like many Americans, I was living paycheck to paycheck. And so when I lost my job, I couldn't pay my rent anymore.
And you've been in the homeless shelter now for how long?
Since May of 2008.
Vanessa LaBarca, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines this morning, Afghan President Hamid Karzai is expected to acknowledge the need for a runoff against his top challenger in the August presidential election. That man, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, is pushing for an interim government through the winter if a runoff can't be organized in the coming weeks. That's according to a report from the Associated Press. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. should not wait for a solution to the political crisis in Afghanistan before making a decision to deploy more troops. His comments are in contrast to those from White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, who said over the weekend a troop decision should be made after there is a credible government in Kabul. In Pakistan, there have been deadly suicide attacks at an Islamic university in the capital. Police say at least four people have been killed in two explosions. It comes as the Pakistani army continues an offensive on the Afghan border.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports the basic Medicare premium will increase 15% next year to a little over $110 a month. That could change if the Senate approves a bill to block the scheduled increase. The House has passed that already. The president has a busy day ahead. This morning, he's due to meet with the Iraqi prime minister in Washington. After that, he comes to New York to attend several fundraisers. We're looking out for some important economic indicators this morning. We'll get figures on housing starts and wholesale inflation a little later. And in health news, some hospitals around the country are turning away visitors in the hopes of limiting the spread of H1N1 or swine flu at their facilities. Wall Street was up about 1% yesterday. The Dow's going to kick off at 10,092. The S&P will start trading at 1098. And the NASDAQ will start at 2176. So we've been asking all morning, with the winter approaching, number one, how do you know when it's winter for you and your family? And number two, what do you do to prepare for it? I was saying earlier that I know it's winter when the first snow comes. But some people say it's winter begins when you turn on the heat, which for many people has already come. So how are you preparing for it? Jamie emails, when I can no longer bike from my house in the Lower East Side to work in Washington Heights because it is so cold. That's when it's winter. 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org to tell us your story.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, I'm thinking about Vanessa's story there. Lose the job, you lose the rent, you lose the home.
It's an odd thing, John, because here we have the Dow Jones again over 10,000, and
right.
Yet we also have reports that we could be facing record numbers of homeless this winter because of the foreclosure crisis. People like Vanessa, who would never before this economic recession have been homeless.
We don't report the homeless number daily like we do the Dow, that's for sure.
That's exactly right. So we're talking about this today, about the new homeless who often lost their homes in the foreclosure crisis and are now ending up in need of shelter. And we'll return to Vanessa LaBarca. She is in Boston. Vanessa lost her job, couldn't find work, and you're now in a private shelter in Boston, correct?
That's right.
With your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You had an opportunity to move elsewhere and possibly find shelter, but your daughter would have been far away from her school.
That's right.
So what do you need? What would you need to get out of shelter? Is it a job? Is that basically the main thing that you need? Or is there other things that they could be doing to help you get out of the homeless shelter?
They do a lot of things here to help us. That's their primary goal. They help us direct us in ways that we can find housing, such as filling out applications for state and federally aided housing projects through the housing authorities in different towns across the state, which I've done. And the lists are very long. It's really discouraging to get a letter back saying that it could be 5 to 7 years before a unit becomes available.
Oh, wow. Vanessa, are you ready for winter?
Yeah.
You are.
Good for her.
I like the winter. I love it.
Libby Hayes is the executive director of Homes for Families, and she joins us from Boston as well. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
How many people do we have, like Vanessa, who have become newly homeless after losing their jobs first, but they've lost their homes because of the foreclosure crisis?
Well, our state shelter system has been full for the past couple of years now. Right now we have over 1,030 families in motels across the state, which is on top of our 2,000 shelter units. And compared to last year, we had about 600 families in motels. In 2007, we had about 35. So we've gone up significantly in the past couple of years.
The state of Massachusetts requires that you find you can't turn people away from homeless shelters. That's why they're ending up in motels.
Yes, as long as a family is deemed eligible and meets strict eligibility requirements, then the state has the responsibility to shelter the families.
Strict eligibility requirements. Does that mean if you're making any money, you're not going to get shelter?
It's about 115% right now of the federal poverty level.
Okay.
So pretty much any family that's working more than part-time.
So let's also bring in James Forestieri, a 31-year-old New Yorker who's living at the Bowery Mission. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
And Steve Berg is with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. He's the vice president for programs and policy. He joins us from Washington, D.C. James, you ended up in a homeless shelter after you left your job diamond trading.
Correct.
And since then, you haven't been able to get a job.
Correct.
Explain to me, it must be, I mean, as hard as it is for somebody who is who has a home to find a job, mm-hmm. It must be doubly harder or more to find a job when you're homeless.
Absolutely. Well, I believe that my experience has been hard for the simple fact is when you lose everything and become homeless, hopelessness follows. So what happens for me is that I start to feel like there is no hope, and then why bother? When you end up having everything and losing everything, and so-called hit bottom, as they say, it's hard to pick yourself back up.
When you say you had everything, what do you mean by that?
I had a great job, had money in the bank, had a fancy title and secretary, and had all the things that society said I should have. And when I lost everything, it was a sense of desperation. I ended up in a place not knowing how I got there.
Are you ready for winter?
A little bit.
A little bit. Steve Berg, you've been hearing these stories from Vanessa and James. Is this a national picture of what's happening with a lot of families and people across the country?
This is absolutely a national picture. I mean, we had gotten to the point in like early 2007 before the recession started where we probably had the fewest homeless people we'd have in 20 years, but there were still 250,000 people homeless then. And since then, unemployment has gone from about 4.5% to about 9.5%. There are thousands and thousands of people who have lost their jobs. And many, many of those people have had the same experience. They lose their jobs. They can't pay for housing. Their families can't support them. And they end up on the streets or in shelters.
Vanessa, how does it complicate your job search that you don't have a permanent address?
Actually, the shelter where I live, I am allowed to use this address, and I decided not to continue to look for a job because through the shelter I learned that I'm eligible for a scholarship, and so I decided to go back to school full time.
Libby, I've got a question for you. You're executive director of Homes for Families up there in Boston, and because you're not allowed by statute to turn people away in Massachusetts, people end up in motels. It sounds like a double whammy in the sense that the economy, it means there's a lot of vacancies in hotels. Is it easy to find placements for people? And explain how it's not really a picnic to be in a motel if you're homeless.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the hotels are getting harder and harder to find with so many families, and also being foliage season in Massachusetts, there's lots of demand on some of the motels here.
Interesting.
But it's not a picnic. There's no cooking facilities in the majority of the motels. We're not putting up families at the Ritz. There's no cooking facilities. There's limited services, limited access to phones, transportation. So a lot of the families are pretty much stuck in a motel on the side of the highway. Transportation's arranged for the kids to get to school, but it's really hard to do job search, to do housing search, and some of the scariest things is just being able to give your children the proper nutrition without the lack of refrigeration, microwaves, cooking facilities.
And that is not a permanent address that somebody would put on a job application, right?
Right.
Libby?
Right.
Steve, is what's happening with people when they go into foreclosure? I mean, people talk a lot about the homeless lag. And I assume what they mean is that it takes a while. Somebody doesn't lose their job and immediately end up at a shelter, right?
Well, right. First let me say, there are people who are having their homes foreclosed that own their homes and then end up in shelter as soon as they're foreclosed. For the most part, the people who are becoming homeless are people who were renting, relatively modest places because it's people whose incomes weren't that high to start with. People who lose their jobs, some don't, but many have family resources to fall back on. They may have savings, they may have credit. So yeah, it does take a while, but some people it takes not very long at all. Other people it takes months or even years of joblessness before they end up homeless. It's a destination a lot of people end up with.
If it's hard enough to take care of the homeless, 250,000, I think you said, before the economic recession, so
right.
Now that the states have even fewer resources than before, how are they supposed to handle these large numbers of people who are newly homeless?
Well, it's been very grim. I mean, I should say that the Obama administration and Congress have come up with $1.5 billion in a new program that's really about helping people pay security deposits, pay a few months' rent, try and either prevent them from becoming homeless in the first place or else get them back into housing, get them help finding a job. That money is just, the state and local governments have gotten the money. They're working really hard to get it out, and it's just now hitting the streets.
Just now.
So hopefully there's some help on the way in some places, but I'm not sure it's going to be enough.
In time, potentially, for winter. James Forestieri, a homeless New Yorker, you live at the Bowery Mission. Do you put that address on your job search application?
Yeah, we can use that as a job search.
And how do you feel about doing that?
It's humbling.
It's humbling?
Very humbling. I think nobody would know that address unless they've been down to the Bowery, as we were talking about, know that area.
James, as a diamond trader, do you know anything about the dealing with the government to get the programs and the income and the assistance that you're going to need to get through this winter?
I do not.
You do not?
I do not. All I know is that I'm at the Bowery Mission. It's not like any typical shelter. What they do is they help with assisting in getting housing, education. I also made a decision. I was just accepted to Nyack College to go back to school and make the best opportunity out of the position I'm in. So what they do at the Bowery Mission is a wide variety of things. They help with education, they plug us into getting trades if you don't have trades. So I don't really know what the national programs are available. I know that what the Bowery offers us is definitely some hope, as I came in hopeless, as I was talking about earlier, allows us to get the most benefits out of ourselves and encourages us to do so.
James Forestieri, 31-year-old homeless New Yorker who lives at the Bowery Mission right now. We also spoke with Vanessa Labarca from Boston, who's at a private shelter there with her daughter. Libby Hayes is executive director of Homes for Families in Massachusetts, and Steve Berg is from the National Alliance to End Homelessness. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Looks like the takeaway here, John, is that it's going to be a hard winter.
Definitely. For people on the street as well, and many more of them this year.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Sure you do. Takeouts now on stories we want you to stay on top of this week, and at least one story we want to catch you up on. We'll start with politics with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, we're going to be talking about the embattled Senator Chris Dodd up in Connecticut and New Jersey Governor John Corzine also embattled a little later on in the program. But we wanted to check in with you about the Federal Election Commission report that was released last week, which is kind of an X-ray of the political stakes in the 2010 off-year election. It sort of tells who's got the money, who doesn't have the money, and who the parties have given up on. First of all, what's the headline out of the FEC report?
Well, the headline is that Republicans are raising a lot of money from small donors. You know, Democrats are expecting a tough election, John, in this 2010 midterms coming up. You have a bad economy, jobs are lagging, two wars going on. The Democrats own these things, and that could mean a tough election time for them. You know, Washington looks at polls a lot, as we all know. But, you know, more than the voting polls, the one thing Washington, the Beltway, really watches, the money.
Well, so, it sort of shows where they're deploying their armies and which races are really, really competitive and which races look to be the competitive races that the parties are staking everything on.
Yeah, so you mentioned Chris Dodd. Let's talk about him real
sure.
quick. Connecticut Democrat, four-term senator running for re-election. He's got a tough bid. Dodd raised $901,000 in the third quarter. Now, this is the FEC, the Federal Election Commission filings came out yesterday just for the third quarter.
It's a reasonable chunk of change.
Yeah, $901,000. Now, his leading Republican opponent, Linda McMahon from World Wrestling, WWE,
sure.
which is located up there in Connecticut, raised $3.5
wow.
million. Now,
wow.
Dodd has $2 million cash on hand, and McMahon has $1.4 million. So she outraised him by a lot, but he's got more cash on hand.
Hmm.
The president was in Philadelphia yesterday raising money for Senator Arlen Specter, who, remember in the summer, switched parties
sure.
from Republican to Democrat because he realized he could never win the Republican Party, the Republican nomination in Pennsylvania. Switched to the Democratic Party, and the president promised him, Arlen, I'll come campaign for you. Specter raised $1.8 million
right.
in a quarter. Three,
pretty
good. His top Republican rival raised $1.6 million. That's Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Now, close, $1.8 million to $1.6 million, neck and neck, right? Arlen Specter's an incumbent. He has $8.7
right.
million
wow.
in the war chest.
Right.
Toomey
wow.
has $1.8 million. So you got to look at the war chest in these things. Let me add one interesting senator for you who's not running this election, John Ensign from Nevada, who raised $301,000 in the second quarter. This quarter three, he raised $33,000.
Wow, that's after
John Ensign's way down. Yeah,
you're seeing problems. Yeah,
you're seeing the effects of his scandal with members of his staff and payoffs and everything else.
All right, Todd Zwillick, thank you so much. The Rorschach of campaign financing there in the Senate and House of Representatives, the Federal Election Commission filings. Thanks, Todd.
Now let's go to Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen to talk about Monday Night Football. What happened last night between the Denver Broncos and San Diego?
In a really, really close game, it went down to Denver winning 34-23 in San Diego with a raucous San Diego crowd. The things that I wanted to focus on here was the throwback uniforms. I know a lot of our listeners...
They're going back to
exactly. Yeah. A lot of our listeners only follow a team, or when there's two teams against each other, they pick the one with the nicer uniforms, right? So the Denver
so public radio listeners do that. Yeah.
A lot. So the Denver Broncos been using the throwback uniforms for when the AFL starts. So they're one of the original AFL teams. It's like a mustard and brown tandem, and then they have these white checkered socks. And most people have the face that you have. That's like, ew,
yeah.
These are ugly.
Yeah, I saw them.
I personally
like them.
Love the uniforms, and they're 6-0 with those uniforms.
Well, a lot of wild stuff happened in the game last night.
Definitely. There was Broncos' Eddie Royale. He ran back a kickoff and a punt return, both for touchdowns, and he's literally the 11th person ever to do that.
Is it normal for the special teams to come in with 21 points?
That's definitely not normal. No, that's a good point.
Yeah.
The Chargers also, what's his name, Darian Sproles, he ran back a kickoff for a touchdown. So it was definitely an amazing game for special teams. And they preach special teams in practice. They preach special teams, you know, before games. And special teams usually comes through that way.
So we're in week six of football. Who should we be watching now? We have a number of undefeated teams, do we not?
We do. And if you're, like I said in the beginning of the season, focus on who has the best offensive lines. Last night, the Chargers couldn't defend and they couldn't protect their quarterback. Teams like Minnesota, New Orleans Saints.
Also undefeated.
Indianapolis Colts and the Denver Broncos, they're all undefeated.
Wow.
They all have very good offensive lines and are all able to protect their quarterback and give them time to do wonderful, wonderful things.
What's the surprise on the Denver team? We didn't think that the Denver Broncos were going to be undefeated at this point in the season.
I think the surprise with them is how there was a lot of criticism of their internal workings early before the season. They had a lot of turmoil. The surprise is that they've been able to shut that out and actually get to work. And that's probably the biggest thing. They have all the talent, all the tools, and all the skills. They have a young head coach, and they've been able to, like, sequester themselves and say, hey, let's do this for ourselves and not listen to all that chatter.
So, I come from Detroit, so I know that you can go completely defeated all season long. But when's the last time we had someone win every game?
Oh, that was 1972, the Miami Dolphins. Oh my God, you don't know that? What are you talking about?
I was barely born.
Everyone must know that. No, the 1972 Miami Dolphins had the only perfect season. They went through the perfect season and they won the Super Bowl. The New England Patriots a couple years ago against the Giants, they had a perfect season going into the Super Bowl and then the Giants stunned them in the Super Bowl. That's why some people think it was one of the best Super Bowls ever.
Okay, thanks so much to Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
A lot of New England fans would say the Pats had a perfect season. A lot of Pats fans would say that. Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. And one of you, I was jealous of this listener, Celeste, who was, quite frankly, mystified by some of our conversation yesterday.
I've been listening to the radio, this report on something about a balloon, something about Colorado. I've been away for a couple of days. I guess I haven't listened to the radio. I don't know what you're talking about.
Something about a balloon?
Yay, Bob. You're totally one of the lucky ones to miss the balloon boy Heaney story of that alleged hoax of floating their 6-year-old son in a weather balloon.
Well, that conversation, that story, sparked a discussion about parenthood and how public some families have become. Elaine told us her parenting story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A couple of years ago, I was in line in a fast food restaurant next to a woman with a couple of kids, and one of them, about 8 or 9, was doing karate kicks right next to me, nearly kicked me a couple of times. Finally, I looked at him and I said, "Stop that." And he did. But the mother yelled at me, "How dare you speak to my child?" So here's the question. When parents can't or won't control the behavior of their children in a public place, do the rest of us just have to put up with it?
I think you karate kick back is the advice there. Celeste, have you ever seen a parent spank a child in public?
I have.
Lisa in Oklahoma called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I have a son. He's 26 now, but throughout his time when he was just growing up, I've always had this paddle his behind in the store at school, and it just didn't seem like it was a big deal to me. It kept my son from having to go to the penitentiary.
Thank you, Lisa. You know, a lot of people responded to the parenting discussion that we had yesterday at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We want to hear all of your responses to what you hear on the radio. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking today about the winter's approach, and this could be a very grim winter. We're wondering, at what point does winter begin for you? Is it when you have to turn on the heat?
Yeah, when you stop using the air conditioning in the car, when you roll up the windows, what is it?
And how are you prepared? 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, Wall Street war chests for political campaigns and Obama's coattails. We'll assess the significance of both of those, anticipating the 2010 midterm elections. More in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Just out in the last few minutes, producer prices declined by a small amount and housing starts were up a little bit. Both are positive economic indicators, and the markets will be reacting to those. In Pakistan, there have been deadly suicide attacks at an Islamic university in the capital, and Afghanistan's election commission has ordered a runoff election for November 7th. Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, has endorsed the runoff in a news conference today.
Here in the U.S., news reports say winter shelters are bracing for higher numbers. As the winter approaches, more Americans are losing their homes and having to move to shelters or stay with friends or families. And federal investigators are looking into the case of an American scientist who's been arrested for attempted espionage. He's accused of providing sensitive information to a person he thought was an Israeli intelligence officer. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So the president's reputation is on the line this week as he travels on the campaign trail to raise money for some embattled Democratic candidates, but it's also stocking the war chest, anticipating the off-year elections in 2010 with money available on Wall Street. Is it available these days? Joining us now is David Kirkpatrick, Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, David.
Hello. Good to be here.
So one of the interesting tests this morning of Barack Obama's political power is his relationship with Wall Street. And you write a little bit about that. He received an enormous amount of support from Wall Street during the campaign in 2008. But what does that relationship look like today?
Well, it's much more complicated. It's more complicated in two ways. First, a number of the big firms on Wall Street, as you know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, have been the recipients of a federal bailout. And a lot of their top executives, the kind of people who could casually drop $30,000 on a presidential fundraiser, are smart enough to know that getting their name connected with that kind of donation to Obama could look bad. So there's a lot of apprehension about that. More broadly, I think a lot of people on Wall Street right now, I know for a fact a lot of people on Wall Street right now are pretty unhappy with the president just because of all of the sort of populist rhetoric coming out of the White House about excessive compensation and these bonuses that are outrageous. They make me angry. How can you guys be lobbying against regulatory reform after you almost brought down the global economy? And while to many Americans that might just seem like common sense, to people on Wall Street who are actually making those multi-million dollar bonuses, they think, hey, you know, I'm just doing my job.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, what do we watch for in the events of this week that might give us an indication of whether money on Wall Street will dry up for the Democrats in the off-year election?
Well, it's going to be hard to tell for a while because we won't see campaign finance reports for this period until later this year. It'll be interesting to see how many people from those big banks turn up at the Obama fundraiser.
Right.
One
of the other really interesting venues to see where the enthusiasm is for any of these candidates, and particularly for Obama and his alleged coattails, is some of the embattled Democrats who are facing election this year, including New Jersey's Governor John Corzine. Bob Henley joins us, political reporter for WNYC Radio. He joins us from New Jersey. Bob Henley, John Corzine is your governor. What is the Wall Street issue in his campaign right now?
Well, he came to national prominence as leading Goldman Sachs. He had a tenure in the U.S. Senate where he was perceived as a capable progressive. When Jim McGreevy, our governor who had the realization that indeed he was gay, resigned and imploded, that opened up an opportunity for Corzine to become the chief executive. As the guy at Goldman Sachs, he was perceived to be the guy that could be brought into New Jersey, a place that has more government than any other place on earth, with some 566 towns, 600 school districts, and a strong home rule tradition. He was the go-to guy that was going to fix it and make it different. Now, with a number of years as an incumbent in the governorship, it got the better of him, and he wasn't able to turn it around. So it's a question of expectations, John. That's what it was. People had high expectations, and he wasn't able to deliver.
Wow. And the question is, can Obama deliver in supporting him as he visits the Corzine campaign? I believe it's tomorrow night, right?
Right, and it wasn't just Obama. It is a tsunami of big blue Democrats. I mean, you have Biden in yesterday, President Clinton in today, Carolyn Kennedy in on Wednesday. So it's a full court press, primarily because the White House sees this as kind of a dress rehearsal for 2010 for those nervous congressional Democrats that want to see just what exactly can this president do. And they're concerned that in a state like New Jersey that has a tradition of voting for Democrats, if Corzine goes down, maybe they're not so much behind the president.
Well, among the nervous Democrats about the 2010 election is Christopher Dodd, the senator in Connecticut. Joining us from Connecticut is Ted Mann, political reporter for the New London Day in Connecticut. Ted, what's the Wall Street issue for Chris Dodd, and how can Obama help him?
Well, Wall Street has always been a major base of support and financial support for Dodd, and that didn't used to be a problem. And in the past year or so, suddenly it's a huge public relations issue for him. He's really struggling in the views of voters back home with the appearance of seeming to be way too close to the finance industry, particularly given his troubles, the scandal about his mortgages that he got through Countrywide as part of this VIP program. And then also the entanglement with AIG. Dodd had been one of the loudest proponents of caps on executive compensation, but he very memorably ended up being the guy who denied and then admitted that he had helped insert into legislation the language that would have permitted their bonuses to go forward.
He wishes it was less memorably,
I think, exactly.
In Connecticut as the campaign is developing. David Kirkpatrick, how important are these two races for Obama's coattails and his ability to assist Democrats in 2010?
Well, one in a different way. As New Jersey is symbolic. You know, New Jersey is a state the Democrats ought to be able to hold. It's certainly suffering economically. And so if Corzine goes down, that makes Obama look bad. Dodd is a big deal in another way, because if you see a Republican, if the Democrats lose that seat to a Republican, then that's going to be bad for their ability to hold on to their commanding majority in the Senate. And it could interfere with what kind of legislative accomplishments the president can have after this first 2-year period of his term.
So, Ted Mann, how entertaining is it to watch Chris Dodd face his opponent, Ms. McMahon, Linda McMahon?
That has been probably the wildest part of it. The one thing Dodd can really hope for, if you look at his poll numbers, he's celebrating having almost climbed back up to 50%. They're terrible by any measure. But the one thing he could hope for is a gigantic Republican primary field that is right now beating the stuffing out of each other, and it has taken on the appearance of a sideshow, and the most notable being Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. And she's fighting with you know, a former congressman,
right,
with a Ron Paul backer, and they've all raised a ton of money, which they're going to use, at least in the short term, to beat up on each other and, as much as on Dodd.
All right. Ted Mann, political reporter for the New London Day in Connecticut, following the Christopher Dodd race. Also, Bob Henley, political reporter for WNYC Radio, and David Kirkpatrick, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, talking about Obama's coattails anticipating the 2010 elections. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has just endorsed a runoff election in a press conference that's still ongoing at this point. He says they'll set runoff elections for November 7th. That comes after a fraud investigation dropped President Hamid Karzai's votes below the 50% total he would have needed, more than 50% in order to win outright. The chairman of the Independent Election Commission, Azizulla Loden, said the commission did not want to leave the people of Afghanistan in uncertainty any longer. Joining us now is the BBC's Amal Pasarlay. He's the deputy head of the Pashto service. Good morning, Amal.
Morning.
You were watching this press conference, which I guess is still ongoing. Did President Karzai explain why he's decided to go for the runoff election now?
In short, no. But all he said is that he is accepting the decision of the Election Commission, and basically he said that though the Election Commission has yet to announce it, but let me announce it to you, the journalist, that the second round of election will be on 7th of November.
Are they going to have those preparations in time, ballots ready and ready to get these out in some tough terrain in Afghanistan to collect this vote?
All these questions remains to be answered. Also, security is an issue, and also the question that whether the fraud issue will not raise again. I mean, all these sort of questions are around, and nobody has any answers to it as yet.
And he did not refer to how they would avoid these kind of accusations of fraud in the upcoming runoff election.
Up till when I was watching and he was giving a speech, he didn't say a word. But I expect that after Senator John Kerry finishes his speech, there will be a press conference. And during that, some journalists might ask that question.
So were people surprised there to hear the president come out and agree to a runoff?
Well, for the past week or so now, everybody was expecting some sort of a deal between President Karzai and Dr. Abdullah, because in the past 8 years, President Karzai is known to be a person who is always good at dealings, and always he is giving a hand to his opponent, and always his cabinet is made of different people. So that was an expectation. And also people were thinking in Afghanistan that the second round of election, there's not enough time logistically, security-wise, and also the winter is upon us. So most of the people were not expecting a second round.
So we are going to see a runoff as of November 7th, they say, between President Hamid Karzai and his opponent, Abdullah Abdullah. And I assume we're expecting a response from Abdullah Abdullah sometime later today, but do we have any inkling of how he's going to react?
Well, I presume that he will be happy and he will be saying that he is going to be there. But there are some rumors also that probably the dealings are still going on, and perhaps America will put some pressure on Dr. Abdullah and make him to stand down because the election, second round of election, is not possible. But that is only rumors. So apparently he might be happy that second round is going on. After all, that's what he was asking for.
Okay, Emil Pasarle is the deputy head of the Pashto service for our partner, the BBC, talking about President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan announcing just a few minutes earlier that he has agreed to runoff elections to be scheduled, he says, for November 7th.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. So as it turns out, goofing off at the office could actually help your productivity. That's something you probably have known for a long time, John, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah, I'm an expert at it, actually, and I'm so productive as a result.
We're also talking about the onset of winter. And how people are planning to deal with it. They say that we have a rise in homelessness, American troops bracing for harsh conditions in Afghanistan. When do you know that it's winter? We have an email from Nick who says, how do I know it's winter? When my calendar says December 21st. Enough with so-called meteorologists telling us things like it's 83 degrees out, but it feels like 91. No, that's just what 83 degrees feels like, numbskulls. It's freaking winter when the Earth tilts its axis fully away from the sun and we reach the shortest day. Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org and tell us what you think. But first, here's a check on news stories at 48 minutes past the hour. As we've been discussing, the Afghan Election Commission has ordered a presidential runoff election between President Hamid Karzai and former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. That's scheduled for November 7th. President Karzai has endorsed that runoff. And in neighboring Pakistan, we're getting reports this morning of an explosion at a university in Islamabad. At least four people are reported dead.
Here in the U.S., a few new economic indicators are out just in the past hour. Housing starts went up 0.5% last month. Meanwhile, wholesale inflation went down 0.6%. That's also due to lower energy costs. New reports say winter shelters are bracing themselves for higher numbers. As winter approaches, more Americans are losing their homes and having to move to shelters or to stay with friends or family. In health news, our partner, the New York Times, reports the basic Medicare premium will increase 15% next year to a little over $110 a month. That could change if the Senate approves a bill to block the scheduled increase. The House passed it already. Looking ahead to tonight, the Yankees play the Angels in Game 4 of the American League Championship Series. The Angels beat the Yankees 5-4 last night in extra innings. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
John, I assume you don't get distracted when you're actually on the air.
I am so focused. I am totally focused.
But when you're sitting at your desk and you're just reading papers,
do
you ever, like, let your
doodling
fingers waddle?
Oh, yeah. I do anything.
Wander over to YouTube.
There's so many ways to be distracted today, too. It's a great century we live in.
Listen to Flynn. He works at a PR firm, and he takes mental breaks in the bathroom at his work.
I didn't feel like for a long time that I could go blow my nose because I had to bill it to somebody. And maybe it was when I was watching this episode of How I Met Your Mother, and they're talking about, you know, should you take a magazine into the bathroom with you? And I just thought, hey, you know, this is the one time of my day where nobody can tell me that I'm taking too much time. So I'd go into the bathroom and started with some reading material, and then it went to Sudoku puzzles. And when I feel like mentally I'm ready to get back to work, I will.
He said he sometimes spends up to an hour in the bathroom reading a book.
Good for him. Thanks for sharing, pal.
So to discuss this, we've got our takeaway contributor, Beth Kobliner. Beth, you would think in this economic climate, people would be so concerned about losing their jobs that they would be more focused than ever.
Right.
But that's not the case.
Right. Sorry, I wasn't listening to you. I was on my BlackBerry. No, just kidding. No, it's true. No, but actually we're seeing that there's been a rise right now in people who are goofing off at work. And I think a lot of it has to do with the economy. I think people are feeling, one of the main reasons they're saying is they're feeling they're underpaid, not just feeling underpaid, they are underpaid, and they're unsatisfied at work. And because of that, they are seeing that, first of all, the line between work and home life is blurred. They're demanded upon more at home. You know, everybody, we email at home, we BlackBerry for work at home. 20% of people who go on vacation say they work on their vacations. We're always reached at any given time. And so people are feeling like when we're at work, we have to do some of our personal things. I mean, when else do you shop for your wedding dress or write the great American novel or do the crossword puzzle?
I don't actually write the great American novel. But we've got David Rock. He's the author of the new book, Your Brain at Work, Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. David, is this just about the fact that people don't get breaks and so now they're taking them?
Well, I think it's a few things. Firstly, we're taxing a part of the brain that we've never taxed like this before. And, you know, the prefrontal cortex and our working memory was supposed to be used kind of once in a while. And just, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't use it anywhere near as much, you know, before email really hit the ground in a big way. And now we're trying to kind of focus on very complicated things for hours and hours on end, and our brain's just not really built to do it. So we
David,
do
I'm so glad. Tired. I'm so glad you mentioned that because my prefrontal cortex has been sore for the last 2 years. I think
it looks swollen too. Mm.
Thank you for noticing.
You know, it's one thing to talk to the guy that we heard from earlier who reads for an hour in the bathroom, but listen to Paige Churchman here.
So it was pretty horrible, and you know, I just needed something to keep myself sane. But I realized that they had, you know, a little monitor outside of every conference room door. So I realized that I could go in, lock the door, then I'd take my shoes off, and I would dance with my iPod. And I would dance for like 40 minutes. It was great.
Beth, she's dancing in a conference room for 40 minutes with the door locked.
I think that's great, you know, and there's some evidence now. The University of Melbourne, leave it to the Australians, I guess, to figure out that actually it's okay to goof off at work a little bit. Their study just came out and showed that if people who goof off at a reasonable amount, and they define that as less than 20% of their total work time.
20% seems less than like 20, a lot.
Less than 20%, that they are actually about 10% more productive during their work time.
You know,
that free time, when you free up your brain and you're dancing around with your iPod and playing with your BlackBerry and, you know, surfing the net, that time then is made up for when you're actually working because you're working harder, stronger, smarter.
Well, the statistics say that in an 8.5-hour workday, the average worker spends nearly 2 hours doing nothing productive at all.
Right.
But you know what you're saying? You're talking about going out and doing something else, reading a book or dancing to your iPod, I guess, to help yourself feel better when you return to the desk. But David, we also had these studies out recently, just a few years ago, saying that one of the best things you can do for your productivity is to take a nap.
Absolutely. I mean, what it's all about is reducing the overall noise in the brain. Think of the kind of what's going on in your brain as like a party, and there's all this electrical activity sparking all the time, almost like the kind of planet Earth from space where you see those thunderstorms. And you know, it's too much noise a lot of the time. And what you want to do is something that quietens it down. And physical activity like dancing can do that, repetitive activities. And definitely taking a nap can dampen the overall noise. And then you can actually kind of see the spikes of activity that occur in your brain. You'll literally be able to hold information together better.
What is it about Australians, David, that makes them real experts at the neurology of goofing off?
I'm not sure. You know, we all live next to the beach, pretty much, and that might be what does it. I'm not sure. It could be the sunshine as well.
So, Beth, it's no surprise that the number one time-wasting activity is Internet search.
Internet and also shopping. 50% of people said they shop online at work pretty regularly.
And I imagine with the holidays coming up,
that it's going to be more. And also job hunting, that's another big one.
So, watching, you know, Fox News.
There you go.
So YouTube has got to be up there.
Right, but keep in mind that 70% of employers actually monitor or can monitor what you're doing online. So that, you know, it's like a virtual water cooler that's going on there, but people are looking at it.
David, you and Beth are talking about how great it is to goof off, but my executive producer is looking at me right now, and I can't imagine if he found me dancing to my iPod in the conference room that he'd be all that happy.
Well, you know, he might. Give him a study that just came out on HBR this month that they actually forced some kind of overworked consultants to take a break. And I tell you, the consultants fought back. They really didn't like it. But they forced them to, and they did find a significant increase in their productivity. So the fact is, you know, the prefrontal cortex isn't a machine. Your ability to have great ideas can't go on all day. You literally do need some downtime. So, show them the research, and if that doesn't work, maybe lock yourself in the bathroom and do
it. I see him dancing right now.
I need some downtime, folks, or I'm not going to get through this next hour of the show.
I'll give you some
downtime.
I'll
have no new ideas.
David Rock is the author of the new book, Your Brain at Work, Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. Beth Kobliner, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Thanks to both of you. And that's Beth Kobliner giving everyone the okay to goof off.
And so that means that we want to hear your goof-off strategies. Give us a call. If you have to disguise what you do, where you are, go for it. You can just reach us at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We won't give away your goof-off strategies to your boss anyway. We'll just tell everyone else.
Actually, we got an email from Mark about what his company does to stop goofing off. He says, my company covered the toilet paper with hard metal covers to prevent head resting on the soft paper.
That's weird. A little
8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Here's another voice.
Typically, I will lock my office door, turn off the lights, and pull out my trusty iPhone to flip through the blogs and just catch up on daily reading for about an hour a day.
All right, and consider how productive that listener must be. Tomorrow, we're going to hold a chili cook-off. Here's the deal. Send us your tried-and-true recipe. And because it's a recession, try to be cost-conscious. We'll share the recipes at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're also looking for your responses about how you know it's winter. And Katie says, I know it's winter when all I want to do is get under the covers and eat macaroni and cheese. 8778-MYTAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Winter officially begins on December 21st, but temperatures are already dropping, and homeless shelters are bracing for record numbers.
I'm out in the cold, body and soul, with nowhere to go. I'm out in the cold.
More and more, the homeless are the working poor, whose homes were washed away in the flood of foreclosures. The new homeless are your friends and neighbors seeking shelter.
I'm out.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 20th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up, we learn that avoiding work may turn out to be an aid to productivity in the brain. We assess the power of Barack Obama to save some troubled Democrats and his possibly waning power to woo contributions from Wall Street. And they're undefeated in Denver, football-wise anyway. And where else are they undefeated? We'll find out.
First, Vanessa LaBarca is with us. She's a single mother in Boston who ended up in a homeless shelter with her daughter after she was laid off. Vanessa, after you lost your job, how long was it before you also lost your home?
It was only a few months. I didn't have any savings, and like many Americans, I was living paycheck to paycheck. And so when I lost my job, I couldn't pay my rent anymore.
And you've been in the homeless shelter now for how long?
Since May of 2008.
Vanessa LaBarca, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines this morning, Afghan President Hamid Karzai is expected to acknowledge the need for a runoff against his top challenger in the August presidential election. That man, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, is pushing for an interim government through the winter if a runoff can't be organized in the coming weeks. That's according to a report from the Associated Press. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. should not wait for a solution to the political crisis in Afghanistan before making a decision to deploy more troops. His comments are in contrast to those from White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, who said over the weekend a troop decision should be made after there is a credible government in Kabul. In Pakistan, there have been deadly suicide attacks at an Islamic university in the capital. Police say at least four people have been killed in two explosions. It comes as the Pakistani army continues an offensive on the Afghan border.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports the basic Medicare premium will increase 15% next year to a little over $110 a month. That could change if the Senate approves a bill to block the scheduled increase. The House has passed that already. The president has a busy day ahead. This morning, he's due to meet with the Iraqi prime minister in Washington. After that, he comes to New York to attend several fundraisers. We're looking out for some important economic indicators this morning. morning. We'll get figures on housing starts and wholesale inflation a little later. And in health news, some hospitals around the country are turning away visitors in the hopes of limiting the spread of H1N1 or swine flu at their facilities. Wall Street was up about 1% yesterday. The Dow's going to kick off at 10,092. The S&P will start trading at 1098. And the NASDAQ will start at 2176. So we've been asking all morning, with the winter approaching, number one, how do you know when it's winter for you and your family? And number two, what do you do to prepare for it? I was saying earlier that I know it's winter when the first snow comes. But some people say it's winter begins when you turn on the heat, which for many people has already come. So how are you preparing for it? Jamie emails, when I can no longer bike from my house in the Lower East Side to work in Washington Heights because it is so cold. That's when it's winter. 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org to tell us your story.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, I'm thinking about Vanessa's story there. Lose the job, you lose the rent, you lose the home.
It's an odd thing, John, because here we have the Dow Jones again over 10,000, and yet we also have reports that we could be facing record numbers of homeless this winter because of the foreclosure crisis. People like Vanessa, who would never before this economic recession have been homeless.
We don't report the homeless number daily like we do the Dow, that's for sure.
That's exactly right. So we're talking about this today, about the new homeless who often lost their homes in the foreclosure crisis and are now ending up in need of shelter. And we'll return to Vanessa LaBarca. She is in Boston. Vanessa lost her job, couldn't find work, and you're now in a private shelter in Boston, correct?
That's right.
With your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You had an opportunity to move elsewhere and possibly find shelter, but your daughter would have been far away from her school.
That's right.
So what do you need? What would you need to get out of shelter? Is it a job? Is that basically the main thing that you need? Or is there other things that they could be doing to help you get out of the homeless shelter?
They do a lot of things here to help us. That's their primary goal. They help us, direct us in ways that we can find housing, such as filling out applications for state and federally aided housing projects through the housing authorities in different towns across the state, which I've done. And the lists are very long. It's really discouraging to get a letter back saying that it could be 5 to 7 years before a unit becomes available.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Vanessa, are you ready for winter?
Yeah.
You are.
Good for her.
I like the winter. I love it.
Libby Hayes is the executive director of Homes for Families, and she joins us from Boston as well. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
How many people do we have, like Vanessa, who have become newly homeless after losing their jobs first, but they've lost their homes because of the foreclosure crisis?
Well, our state shelter system has been full for the past couple of years now. Right now, we have over 1,030 families in motels across the state, which is on top of our 2,000 shelter units. And compared to last year, we had about 600 families in motels. In 2007, we had about 35, so we've gone up significantly in the past couple of years.
The state of Massachusetts requires that you find you can't turn people away from homeless shelters. That's why they're ending up in motels.
Yes, as long as a family is deemed eligible and meets strict eligibility requirements, then the state has the responsibility to shelter the families.
Strict eligibility requirements, does that mean if you're making any money, you're not going to get shelter?
It's about 115% right now of the federal poverty level.
Okay.
So pretty much any family that's working more than part-time.
So let's also bring in James Forestieri, a 31-year-old New Yorker who's living at the Bowery Mission. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
And Steve Berg is with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. He's the vice president for programs and policy. He joins us from Washington, D.C. James, you ended up in a homeless shelter after you left your job diamond trading.
Correct.
And since then, you haven't been able to get a job.
Correct.
Explain to me, as hard as it is for somebody who is who has a home to find a job, mm-hmm. It must be doubly harder or more to find a job when you're homeless.
Absolutely. I believe that in my experience, it's been hard for the simple fact is when you lose everything and become homeless, hopelessness follows. So what happens for me is that I start to feel like there is no hope. And then why bother? When you end up having everything and losing everything, and so-called hit bottom, as they say, it's hard to pick yourself back up.
When you say you had everything, what do you mean by that?
I had a great job, had money in the bank, had a fancy title and secretary and had all the things that society said I should have. And when I lost everything, it was a sense of desperation. I ended up in a place not knowing how I got there.
Are you ready for winter?
A little bit.
A little bit. Steve Berg, you've been hearing these stories from Vanessa and James. Is this a national picture of what's going happening with a lot of families and people across the country?
Yeah, this is absolutely a national picture. I mean, we had gotten to the point in like early 2007 before the recession started where we probably had the fewest homeless people we'd have in 20 years, but there were still 250,000 people homeless then. And since then, unemployment has gone from about 4.5% to about 9.5%. There are thousands and thousands of people who have lost their jobs. And many, many of those people have had the same experience. They lose their jobs. They can't pay for housing. Their families can't support them, and they end up on the streets or in shelters.
Vanessa, how does it complicate your job search that you don't have a permanent address?
Actually, the shelter where I live, I am allowed to use this address, and I decided not to continue to look for a job because through the shelter I learned that I'm eligible for a scholarship, and so I decided to go back to school full time.
Libby, I've got a question for you. You're executive director of Homes for Families up there in Boston. And because you're not allowed by statute to turn people away in Massachusetts, people end up in motels. It sounds like a double whammy in the sense that the economy, it means there's a lot of vacancies in hotels. Is it easy to find placements for people? And explain how it's not really a picnic to be in a motel if you're homeless.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the hotels are getting harder and harder to find with so many families and also being foliage season. In Massachusetts, there's lots of demand on some of the motels here.
Interesting.
But it's not a picnic. There's no cooking facilities in the majority of the motels. We're not putting up families at the Ritz. There's no cooking facilities. There's limited services, limited access to phones, transportation. So a lot of the families are pretty much stuck in a motel on the side of the highway. Transportation's arranged for the kids to get to school, but it's really hard to do job search, to do housing search, and some of the scariest things is just being able to give your children the proper nutrition without the lack of refrigeration, microwaves, cooking facilities.
And that is not a permanent address that somebody would put on a job application, right?
Right.
Libby?
Right.
Steve, is what's happening with people when they go into foreclosure? I mean, people talk a lot about the homeless lag. And I assume what they mean is that it takes a while. Somebody doesn't lose their job and immediately end up at a shelter, right?
Well, right. First let me say, there are people who are having their homes foreclosed that own their homes and then end up in shelter as soon as they're foreclosed. For the most part, the people who are becoming homeless are people who were renting, relatively modest places because it's people whose incomes weren't that high to start with. People who lose their jobs, but many have family resources to fall back on. They may have savings, they may have credit. So yeah, it does take a while, but some people it takes not very long at all. Other people it takes months or even years of joblessness before they end up homeless. It's a destination a lot of people end up with.
If it's hard enough to take care of the homeless, 250,000, I think you said, before the economic recession, so
right.
Now that the states have even fewer resources than before, how are they supposed to handle these large numbers of people who are newly homeless?
Well, it's been very grim. I mean, I should say that the Obama administration and Congress have come up with $1.5 billion in a new program that's really about helping people pay security deposits, pay a few months' rent, try and either prevent them from becoming homeless in the first place, or else get them back into housing, get them help finding a job. That money is just, the state and local governments have gotten the money. They're working really hard to get it out, and it's just now hitting the streets.
Just now.
So hopefully, there's some help on the way in some places. But I'm not sure it's going to be enough
in time potentially for winter. James Forestieri, a homeless New Yorker, you live at the Bowery Mission. Do you put that address on your job search application?
We can use that as a job search.
And how do you feel about doing that?
It's humbling.
It's humbling.
Very humbling. I think nobody would know that address unless they've been down to the Bahari, as we're talking about, know that area.
James, as a diamond trader, do you know anything about the dealing with the government to get the programs and the income and the assistance that you're going to need to get through this winter?
I do not.
You do not?
I do not. All I know is that I'm at the Bahari Mission. It's not like any typical shelter. What they do is they help with assistance in getting housing, education. I also made a decision. I was just accepted to Nyack College to go back to school and make the best opportunity out of the position I'm in. So what they do with the Bahari Mission is a wide variety of things. They help with education, with they plug us into getting trades if you don't have trades. So I don't really know what the national programs are available. I know that what the Bahari offers us is definitely some hope, as I came in hopeless, as I was talking about earlier, and allows us to get the most benefits out of ourselves and encourage us to do so.
James Forestieri, a 31-year-old homeless New Yorker who lives at the Bahari Mission right now. We also spoke with Vanessa Labarca from Boston, who's at a private shelter there with her daughter. Libby Hayes is executive director of Homes for Families in Massachusetts, and Steve Berg is from the National Alliance to End Homelessness. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Looks like the takeaway here, John, is that it's going to be a hard winter.
Definitely. For people on the street as well, and many more of them this year.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Sure you do. Takeouts now on stories we want you to stay on top of this week, and at least one story we want to catch you up on. We'll start with politics with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, we're going to be talking about the embattled Senator Chris Dodd up in Connecticut and New Jersey Governor John Corzine also embattled a little later on in the program. But we wanted to check in with you about the Federal Election Commission report that was released last week, which is kind of an X-ray of the political stakes in the 2010 off-year election. It sort of tells who's got the money, who doesn't have the money, and who the parties have given up on. First of all, what's the headline out of the FEC report?
Well, the headline is that Republicans are raising a lot of money from small donors. You know, Democrats are expecting a tough election, John, in this 2010 midterms coming up. You have a bad economy, jobs are lagging, two wars going on. The Democrats own these things, and that could mean a tough election time for them. You know, Washington looks at polls a lot, as we all know. But, you know, more than the voting polls, the one thing Washington, the Beltway, really watches, the money, the money, the money, the money.
Well, so, it sort of shows where they're deploying their armies and which races are really, really competitive and which races look to be the competitive races that the parties are staking everything on.
Yeah, so you mentioned Chris Dodd. Let's talk about him real
quick.
Connecticut Democrat, four-term senator running for re-election. He's got a tough bid. Dodd raised $901,000 in the third quarter. Now, this is the FEC, the Federal Election Commission filings came out yesterday just for the third quarter.
It's a reasonable chunk of change.
Yeah, $901,000. Now, his leading Republican opponent, Linda McMahon from World Wrestling, WWE, which is located up there in Connecticut, raised $3.5 million. Now, Dodd has $2 million cash on hand, and McMahon has $1.4 million. So she outraised him by a lot, but he's got more cash on hand. The president was in Philadelphia yesterday raising money for Senator Arlen Specter, who, remember, in the summer switched parties from Republican to Democrat because he realized he could never win the Republican Party, the Republican nomination in Pennsylvania. Switched to the Democratic Party, and the president promised him, Arlen, I'll come campaign for you. Specter raised $1.8 million in a quarter three.
Which is good.
Pretty good. His top Republican rival raised $1.6 million. That's Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Now, close. $1.8 million to $1.6 million, neck and neck, right? Arlen Specter's an incumbent. He has $8.7 million in the war chest.
Right.
Toomey has $1.8 million. So you got to look at the war chest in these things. Let me add one interesting senator for you who's not running this election, John Ensign from Nevada, who raised $301,000 in the second quarter. This quarter three, he raised $33,000.
Wow, that's after
Jonathan's
his
way down. Yeah,
scandal
you're seeing the
problems. Yeah,
you're seeing the effects of his scandal with members of his staff and payoffs and everything else.
All right, Todd Zwillick, thank you so much. The Rorschach of campaign financing there in the Senate and House of Representatives, the Federal Election Commission filings. Thanks, Todd.
Now let's go to Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen to talk about Monday Night Football. What happened last night between the Denver Broncos and San Diego?
In a really, really close game, it went down to Denver winning 34-23 in San Diego with a raucous San Diego crowd. The things that I wanted to focus on here was the throwback uniforms. I know a lot of folks, a lot of our listeners...
They're going back to
exactly. Yeah. A lot of our listeners only follow a team, or when there's two teams against each other, they pick the one with the nicer uniforms, right? So the Denver
public radio listeners do that.
So the Denver Broncos have been using the throwback uniforms for when the AFL starts. So they're one of the original AFL teams. It's like a mustard and brown tandem, and then they have these white checkered socks. And most people have the face that you have that's like, ew, yeah, these are ugly.
I personally
love the uniforms, and they're 6-0 with those uniforms.
Well, a lot of wild stuff happened in the game last night.
Definitely. There was Broncos Eddie Royale. He ran back a kickoff and a punt return, both for touchdowns. And he's literally the 11th person ever to do that.
Is it normal for the special teams to come in with 21 points?
That's definitely not normal. No, that's a good point. The Chargers also... what's his name? Darian Sproles. He ran back a kickoff for a touchdown. So it was definitely an amazing game for special teams. And they preach special teams in practice. They preach special teams, you know, before games. And special teams usually comes through that way.
So we're in week six of football. Who should we be watching now? We have a number of undefeated teams, do we not?
We do. And if you're like I said in the beginning of the season, focus on who has the best offensive lines. Last night, the Chargers couldn't defend and they couldn't protect their quarterback. Teams like Minnesota, New Orleans Saints.
Undefeated.
Indianapolis Colts and the Denver Broncos, they're all undefeated. Wow. They all have very good offensive lines and are all able to protect their quarterback and give them time to do wonderful, wonderful things.
What's the surprise on the Denver team? We didn't think that the Denver Broncos were going to be undefeated at this point in the season.
I think the surprise with them is how there was a lot of criticism of their internal workings early before the season. They had a lot of turmoil. The surprise is that they've been able to shut that out and actually get to work. And that's probably the biggest thing. They have all the talent, all the tools, and all the skills. They have a young head coach, and they've been able to, like, sequester themselves and say, hey, let's do this for ourselves and not listen to all that chatter.
So, I come from Detroit, so I know that you can go completely defeated all season long. But when's the last time we had someone win every game?
Oh, that was 1972, the Miami Dolphins. Oh my God, you don't know that? What are you talking about?
I was barely born.
Everyone must know that. No, the 1972 Miami Dolphins had the only perfect season. They went through the perfect season and they won the Super Bowl. The New England Patriots a couple years ago against the Giants, they had a perfect season going into the Super Bowl and then the Giants stunned them in the Super Bowl. That's why some people think it was one of the best Super Bowls ever.
Okay, thanks so much to Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
A lot of New England fans would say the Pats had a perfect season. A lot of Pats fans would say that. Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. And one of you, I was jealous of this listener, Celeste, who was, quite frankly, mystified by some of our conversation yesterday.
I've been listening to the radio, this report on something about a balloon, something about Colorado. I've been away for a couple of days. I guess I haven't listened to the radio. I don't know what you're talking about.
Something about a balloon?
Yay, Bob. You're totally one of the lucky ones to miss the balloon boy Heaney story of that alleged hoax of floating their 6-year-old son in a weather balloon.
Well, that conversation, that story, sparked a discussion about parenthood and how public some families have become. Elaine told us her parenting story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A couple of years ago, I was in line in a fast food restaurant next to a woman with a couple of kids, and one of them, about 8 or 9, was doing karate kicks right next to me, nearly kicked me a couple of times. Finally, I looked at him and I said, "Stop that." And he did. But the mother yelled at me, "How dare you speak to my child?" So here's the question. When parents can't or won't control the behavior of their children in a public place, do the rest of us just have to put up with it?
I think you karate kick back is the advice there. Celeste, have you ever seen a parent spank a child in public?
I have.
Lisa in Oklahoma called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I have a son, 26 now, but throughout his time when he was growing up, I've always had this paddle his behind in the store at school, and it just didn't seem like it was a big deal to me. It kept my son from having to go to the penitentiary.
Thank you, Lisa. You know, a lot of people responded to the parenting discussion that we had yesterday at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
We want to hear all of your responses to what you hear on the radio. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking today about the winter's approach, and this could be a very grim winter. We're wondering, at what point does winter begin for you? Is it when you have to turn on the heat?
Yeah, when you stop using the air conditioning in the car, when you roll up the windows, what is it?
And how are you prepared? 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, Wall Street war chests for political campaigns and Obama's coattails. We'll assess the significance of both of those, anticipating the 2010 midterm elections. More in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Just out in the last few minutes, producer prices declined by a small amount and housing starts were up a little bit. Both are positive economic indicators, and the markets will be reacting to those. In Pakistan, there have been deadly suicide attacks at an Islamic university in the capital, and Afghanistan's election commission has ordered a runoff election for November 7th. Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, has endorsed the runoff in a news conference today.
Here in the U.S., news reports say winter shelters are bracing for higher numbers. As the winter approaches, more Americans are losing their homes and having to move to shelters or stay with friends or families. And federal investigators are looking into the case of an American scientist who's been arrested for attempted espionage. He's accused of providing sensitive information to a person he thought was an Israeli intelligence officer. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So the president's reputation is on the line this week as he travels on the campaign trail to raise money for some embattled Democratic candidates. But it's also stocking the war chest, anticipating the off-year elections in 2010 with money available on Wall Street. Is it available these days? Joining us now is David Kirkpatrick, Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, David.
Hello. Good to be here.
So one of the interesting tests this morning of Barack Obama's political power is his relationship with Wall Street. And you write a little bit about that. He received an enormous amount of support from Wall Street during the campaign in 2008. But what does that relationship look like today?
Well, it's much more complicated. It's more complicated in two ways. First, a number of the big firms on Wall Street, as you know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, have been the recipients of a federal bailout. And a lot of their top executives, the kind of people who could casually drop $30,000 on a presidential fundraiser, are smart enough to know that getting their name connected with that kind of donation to Obama could look bad. So there's a lot of apprehension about that. More broadly, I think a lot of people on Wall Street right now, I know for a fact a lot of people on Wall Street right now are pretty unhappy with the president just because of all of the sort of populist rhetoric coming out of the White House about excessive compensation and these bonuses that are outrageous. They make me angry. How can you guys be lobbying against regulatory reform after you almost brought down the global economy? And while to many Americans that might just seem like common sense, to people on Wall Street who are actually making those multimillion-dollar bonuses, they think, hey, you know, I'm just doing my job.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, what do we watch for in the events of this week that might give us an indication of whether money on Wall Street will dry up for the Democrats in the off-year election?
Well, it's going to be hard to tell for a while because we won't see campaign finance reports for this period until later this year. It'll be interesting to see how many people from those big banks turn up at the Obama fundraiser.
Right.
One
of the other really interesting venues to see where the enthusiasm is for any of these candidates, and particularly for Obama and his alleged coattails, is some of the embattled Democrats who are facing election this year, including New Jersey's Governor John Corzine. Bob Henley joins us, political reporter for WNYC Radio. He joins us from New Jersey. Bob Henley, John Corzine is your governor. What is the Wall Street issue in his campaign right now?
Well, he came to national prominence as leading Goldman Sachs. He had a tenure in the U.S. Senate where he was perceived as a capable progressive. When Jim McGreevy, our governor who had the realization that indeed he was gay, resigned and imploded, that opened up an opportunity for Corzine to become the chief executive. As the guy at Goldman Sachs, he was perceived to be the guy that could be brought into New Jersey, a place that has more government than any other place on earth, with some 566 towns, 600 school districts, and a strong home rule tradition. He was the go-to guy that was going to fix it and make it different. Now, with a number of years as an incumbent in the governorship, it got the better of him, and he wasn't able to turn it around. So it's a question of expectations, John. That's what it was. People had high expectations, and he wasn't able to deliver.
Wow. And the question is, can Obama deliver in supporting him as he visits the Corzine campaign? I believe it's tomorrow night, right?
Right, and it wasn't just Obama. It is a tsunami of big blue Democrats. I mean, you have Biden in yesterday, President Clinton in today, Carolyn Kennedy in on Wednesday. So it's a full court press primarily because the White House sees this as kind of a dress rehearsal for 2010 for those nervous congressional Democrats that want to see just what exactly can this president do. And they're concerned that in a state like New Jersey that has a tradition of voting for Democrats, if Corzine goes down, maybe they're not so much behind the president.
Well, among the nervous Democrats about the 2010 election is Christopher Dodd, the senator in Connecticut. Joining us from Connecticut is Ted Mann, political reporter for the New London Day in Connecticut. Ted, what's the Wall Street issue for Chris Dodd, and how can Obama help him?
Well, Wall Street has always been a major base of support and financial support for Dodd, and that didn't used to be a problem. And in the past year or so, suddenly it's a huge public relations issue for him. He's really struggling in the views of voters back home with the appearance of seeming to be way too close to the finance industry. Particularly given his troubles, the scandal about his mortgages that he got through Countrywide as part of this VIP program. And then also the entanglement with AIG. Dodd had been one of the loudest proponents of caps on executive compensation, but he very memorably ended up being the guy who denied and then admitted that he had helped insert into legislation the language that would have permitted right. their bonuses to go forward.
He wishes it was less memorably,
I think,
in Connecticut, as the campaign is developing. David Kirkpatrick, how important are these two races for Obama's coattails and his ability to assist Democrats in 2010?
Well, each one in a different way. As New Jersey is symbolic. You know, New Jersey is a state the Democrats ought to be able to hold. It's certainly suffering economically. And so if Corzine goes down, that makes Obama look bad. Dodd is a big deal in another way, because if you see a Republican, if the Democrats lose that seat to a Republican, then that's going to be bad for their ability to hold on to their commanding majority in the Senate. And it could interfere with what kind of legislative accomplishments the president can have after this first two-year period of his term.
So, Ted Mann, how entertaining is it to watch Chris Dodd face his opponent, Ms. McMahon, Linda McMahon?
That has been probably the wildest part of it. The one thing Dodd can really hope for, if you look at his poll numbers, he's celebrating having almost climbed back up to 50%. They're terrible by any measure. But the one thing he could hope for is a gigantic Republican primary field that is right now beating the stuffing out of each other, and it has taken on the appearance of a sideshow, and the most notable being Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. And she's fighting with a former congressman,
right.
with a Ron Paul backer, and they've all raised a ton of money, which they're going to use, at least in the short term, to beat up on each other and, as much as on Dodd.
All right. Ted Mann, political reporter for the New London Day in Connecticut, following the Christopher Dodd race. Also, Bob Henley, political reporter for WNYC Radio, and David Kirkpatrick, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, talking about Obama's coattails anticipating the 2010 elections. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has just endorsed a runoff election in a press conference that's still ongoing at this point. He says they'll set runoff elections for November 7th. That comes after a fraud investigation dropped President Hamid Karzai's votes below the 50% total he would have needed, more than 50% in order to win outright. The chairman of the Independent Election Commission, Azizullah Loden, said the commission did not want to leave the people of Afghanistan in uncertainty any longer. Joining us now is the BBC's Imal Pasarle. He's the deputy head of the Pashto service. Good morning, Imal.
Morning.
You were watching this press conference, which I guess is still ongoing. Did President Karzai explain why he's decided to go for the runoff election now?
In short, no. But all he said is that he is accepting the decision of the Election Commission, and basically he said that though the Election Commission has yet to announce it, but let me announce it to you, the journalists, that the second round of election will be on 7th of November.
Are they going to have those preparations in time, ballots ready and ready to get these out in some tough terrain in Afghanistan to collect this vote?
All these questions remains to be answered. Also, security is an issue, and also the question that whether the fraud issue will not raise again. I mean, all these sort of questions are around, and nobody has any answers to it as yet.
And he did not refer to how they would avoid these kind of accusations of fraud in the upcoming runoff election.
Up till when I was watching and he was giving a speech, he didn't say a word. But I expect that after Senator John Kerry finishes his speech, there will be a press conference. And during that, some journalists might ask that question.
So were people surprised there to hear the president come out and agree to a runoff?
Well, for the past week or so now, everybody was expecting some sort of a deal between President Karzai and Dr. Abdullah, because in the past 8 years, President Karzai is known to be a person who is always good at dealings, and always he is giving a hand to his opponent, and always his cabinet is made of different people. So that was an expectation. And also people were thinking in Afghanistan that the second round of election, there's not enough time logistically, security-wise, and also the winter is upon us. So most of the people are not expecting a second round.
So we are going to see a runoff as of November 7th, they say, between President Hamid Karzai and his opponent, Abdullah Abdullah. And I assume we're expecting a response from Abdullah Abdullah sometime later today, but do we have any inkling of how he's going to react?
Well, I presume that he will be happy and he will be saying that he is going to be there. But there are some rumors also that probably the dealings are still going on, and perhaps America will put some pressure on Dr. Abdullah and make him to stand down because the election, second round of election, is not possible. But that is only rumors. So apparently he might be happy that second round is going on. After all, that's what he was asking for.
Okay, Emil Pasarle is the deputy head of the Pashto service for our partner, the BBC, talking about President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan announcing just a few minutes earlier that he has agreed to runoff elections to be scheduled, he says, for November 7th.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. So as it turns out, goofing off at the office could actually help your productivity. That's something you probably have known for a long time, John, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah, I'm an expert at it, actually, and I'm so productive as a result.
We're also talking about the onset of winter. And how people are planning to deal with it. They say that we have a rise in homelessness, American troops bracing for harsh conditions in Afghanistan. When do you know that it's winter? We have an email from Nick who says, how do I know it's winter? When my calendar says December 21st. Enough with so-called meteorologists telling us things like it's 83 degrees out, but it feels like 91. No, that's just what 83 degrees feels like, numbskulls. It's freaking winter when the Earth tilts its axis fully away from the sun and we reach the shortest day. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org and tell us what you think. But first, here's a check on news stories at 48 minutes past the hour. As we've been discussing, the Afghan Election Commission has ordered a presidential runoff election between President Hamid Karzai and former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. That's scheduled for November 7th. President Karzai has endorsed that runoff. And in neighboring Pakistan, we're getting reports this morning of an explosion at a university in Islamabad. At least 4 people are reported dead.
Here in the U.S., a few new economic indicators are out just in the past hour. Housing starts went up 0.5% last month. Meanwhile, wholesale inflation went down 0.6%. That's also due to lower energy costs. New reports say winter shelters are bracing themselves for higher numbers. As winter approaches, more Americans are losing their homes and having to move to shelters or to stay with friends or family. In health news, our partner, the New York Times, reports the basic Medicare premium will increase 15% next year to a little over $110 a month. That could change if the Senate approves a bill to block the scheduled increase. The House passed it already. Looking ahead to tonight, the Yankees play the Angels in Game 4 of the American League Championship Series. The Angels beat the Yankees 5-4 last night in extra innings. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
John, I assume you don't get distracted when you're actually on the air.
I am so focused. I am totally focused.
But when you're sitting at your desk and you're just reading papers,
I'm
do you ever, like, let your
doodling.
Fingers waddle?
Oh, yeah. I do anything.
Wander over to YouTube.
There's so many ways to be distracted today, too. It's a great century we live in.
Listen to Flynn talk. He works at a PR firm, and he takes mental breaks in the bathroom at his work.
I didn't feel like for a long time that I could go blow my nose because I had to bill it to somebody. And maybe it was when I was watching this episode of How I Met Your Mother, and they're talking about, you know, should you take a magazine into the bathroom with you? And I just thought, hey, you know, this is the one time of my day where nobody can tell me that I'm taking too much time. So I'd go into the bathroom and started with some reading material, and then it went to Sudoku puzzles. And when I feel like mentally I'm ready to get back to work, I will.
He said he sometimes spends up to an hour in the bathroom reading a book.
Good for him. Thanks for sharing, pal.
So to discuss this, we've got our takeaway contributor, Beth Kobliner. Beth, you would think in this economic climate, people would be so concerned about losing their jobs that they would be more focused than ever.
Right.
But that's not the case.
Right. Sorry, I wasn't listening to you. I was on my BlackBerry. No, uh-huh. Just kidding. No, it's true. No, but actually we're seeing that there's been a rise right now in people who are goofing off at work. And I think a lot of it has to do with the economy. I think people are feeling, one of the main reasons they're saying is they're underpaid, not just feeling underpaid, they are underpaid, and they're unsatisfied at work. And because of that, they are seeing that, first of all, the line between work and home life is blurred. They're demanded upon more at home. You know, everybody, we email at home, we BlackBerry for work at home. 20% of people who go on vacation say they work on their vacations. We're always reached at any given time. And so people are feeling like when we're at work, we have to do some of our personal things. I mean, when else do you shop for your wedding dress or write the great American novel or do the crossword puzzle?
I don't actually write the great American novel. But we've got David Rock. He's the author of the new book, Your Brain at Work, Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. David, is this just about the fact that people don't get breaks and so now they're taking them?
Well, I think it's a few things. Firstly, we're taxing a part of the brain that we've never taxed like this before. And, you know, the prefrontal cortex and our working memory was supposed to be used kind of once in a while. And just, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't use it anywhere near as much, you know, before email really hit the ground in a big way. And now we're trying to kind of focus on very complicated things for hours and hours on end, and our brain's just not really built to do it. So we
David,
do
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because my prefrontal cortex has been sore for the last 2 years, I think.
It looks swollen, too. Yeah.
Thank you for noticing.
You know, it's one thing to talk to the guy that we heard from earlier who reads for an hour in the bathroom, but listen to Paige Churchman here.
So it was pretty horrible, and, you know, I just needed something to keep myself sane. But I realized that they had, you know, a little monitor outside of every conference room door. So I realized that I could go in, lock the door, then I'd take my shoes off, and I would dance with my iPod. And I would dance for like 40 minutes. It was great.
Beth, she's dancing in a conference room for 40 minutes with the door locked.
I think that's great, you know, and there's some evidence now. The University of Melbourne, leave it to the Australians, I guess, to figure out that actually it's okay to goof off at work a little bit. Their study just came out and showed that if people who goof off at a reasonable amount, and they define that as less than 20% of their total work time.
20% seems less than like
20,
a lot.
Less than 20%, that they are actually about 10% more productive during their work time. That free time, when you free up your brain and you're dancing around with your iPod and playing with your BlackBerry and, you know, surfing the net, that time then is made up for when you're actually working, because you're working harder, stronger, smarter.
Well, the statistics say that in an 8.5-hour workday, the average worker spends nearly 2 hours doing nothing productive at all.
Right.
But, you know, what you're saying, you're talking about going out and doing something else, reading a book or dancing to your iPod, I guess, to help yourself feel better when you return to the desk. But, David, we also had these studies out recently, just a few years ago, saying that one of the best things you can do for your productivity is to take a nap.
Absolutely. I mean, what it's all about is reducing the overall noise in the brain. Think of the kind of what's going on in your brain as like a party, and there's all this electrical activity sparking all the time, almost like the kind of planet Earth from space, where you see those thunderstorms, and you know, it's too much noise a lot of the time. And what you want to do is something that quietens it down. And physical activity like dancing can do that, repetitive activities, and definitely taking a nap can dampen the overall noise. And then you can actually kind of see the spikes of activity that occur in your brain. You'll literally be able to hold information together better.
What is it about Australians, David, that makes them real experts at the neurology of goofing off?
I'm not sure. You know, we all live next to the beach, pretty much, and that might be what does it. I'm not sure. It could be the sunshine as well.
So, Beth, it's no surprise that the number one time-wasting activity is internet search.
Internet and also shopping. 50% of people said they shop online at work pretty regularly.
And I imagine with the holidays coming up,
that it's going to be more. And also job hunting, that's another big one.
So, watching Fox News.
There you go.
So YouTube has got to be up there.
Right, but keep in mind that 70% of employers actually monitor or can monitor what you're doing online. So that, you know, it's like a virtual water cooler that's going on there, but people are looking at it.
David, you and Beth are talking about how great it is to goof off, but my executive producer is looking at me right now, and I can't imagine if he found me dancing to my iPod in the conference room that he'd be all that happy.
Well, you know, he might. Give him a study that just came out on HBR this month that they actually forced some kind of overworked consultants to take a break. And I tell you, the consultants fought back. They really didn't like it. But they forced them to, and they did find a significant increase in their productivity. So the fact is, you know, the prefrontal cortex isn't a machine. Your ability to have great ideas can't go on all day. You literally do need some downtime. So, show them the research and... If that doesn't work, maybe lock yourself in the bathroom and do it.
I see him dancing right now.
I need some downtime, folks, or I'm not going to get through this next hour of the show.
I'll give you some downtime.
I have no new ideas.
David Rock is the author of the new book, Your Brain at Work, Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. Beth Kobliner, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Thanks to both of you. And that's Beth Kobliner giving everyone the okay to goof off.
And so that means that we want to hear your goof-off strategies. Give us a call. If you have to disguise what you do, where you are, go for it. You can just reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We won't give away your goof-off strategies to your boss anyway. We'll just tell everyone else.
Actually, we got an email from Mark about what his company does to stop goofing off. He says, my company covered the toilet paper with hard metal covers to prevent head resting on the soft paper.
That's weird. A little strange.
877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Here's another voice.
Typically, I will lock my office door, turn off the lights, and pull out my trusty iPhone to flip through the blogs and just catch up on daily reading for about an hour a day.
All right, and consider how productive that listener must be. Tomorrow, we're going to hold a chili cook-off. Here's the deal. Send us your tried-and-true recipe, and because it's a recession, try to be cost-conscious. We'll share the recipes at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're also looking for your responses about how you know it's winter, and Katie says, I know it's winter when all I want to do is get under the covers and eat macaroni and cheese. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.